All right, thanks everyone. Please have a seat. This is 12 SC 906 Justice versus the State of Colorado and others. I should announce that Justice Ide and Justice Marquez will not be participating in this case. May I have the entry of appearances, please?
For plaintiff petitioners, Richard Rosenblatt, I will be arguing the case, and with me is my co-counsel, William Payne.
Thank you very much. And for the respondents?
Morning, Your Honor. Sean Pound, the parent, and we ask that Sarah Caleb Durham with me, and I'll be providing at least 10 minutes with me.
Dan Vacco, Solicitor General, on behalf of Governor Hickman Hoover and the State of Colorado.
All right, gentlemen, you'll have to just decide how you divide your time yourselves. And you seem to have all done so that's good. This is a 1 hour case. That means each side has 1 half hour. Mr. Rosenblatt, you'll have to keep track of your own time. And if you want to reserve any time, you should just do so.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir, whenever you're ready.
So I don't need to tell you ahead of time that I'm reserving. Just make sure at the end.
You don't. That's right. Okay. Whatever time we don't use has been reserved.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning, everyone. May it please the court. My name is Richard Rosenblatt, and I'm appearing on behalf of plaintiff petitioners today. I won't recite the facts again. I'll get right to the questions posed by the court unless the court wishes otherwise. The first question posed by the court was whether the framework in the WIT applies. It is the position of petitioner plaintiffs that the third factor, substantial impairment, which is shown by whether the expectations have been frustrated and it is reasonable and necessary to look to serve a significant and legitimate public purpose, does not apply in this type of case. Or put differently, another way to look at it is, if it does apply, it is per se unreasonable. To understand this outcome and that determination, one must look to other decisions by this court, specifically three decisions. A decision in 1959 called McPhail, a decision in 1960 called Bills, and then a decision by this court in 1988 called Peterson. In McPhail, the court found a fully vested contract right in the form of COLA, and ruled that the government entity could not unilaterally reduce that. It was unconstitutional under the contract clause. Just a year later, you had the Bills decision. In Bills, they dealt with not a fully vested right, but what they described as a limited vested right. And unlike the fully vested right, in Bills, they apply the reasonable and necessary defense. Specifically, what they said was, since it's an incohate right, it has not been fulfilled like it had been fulfilled in McPhail, that the government entity could constitutionally impair that limited vested right by making, if the adverse change was done with a beneficial change of equal value, or it was actuarially necessary, or it strengthened the plan. In other words, if you look at these two cases together, which I think you need to do to understand that the court was saying, if it's a fully vested right, you can't impair in any way that under the contract clause. But if it's not a fully vested right, you can impair it. The Court of Appeals and the defendants in this case claim that the decision of DeWitt and the U.S. Supreme Court cases before it somehow changed the test that had not been considered in the McPhail Bills litany. We would strongly disagree with that. In 1938, the Supreme Court decided the Blaisdell decision, and in Blaisdell, they made it very clear that you could impair a contractual right under the contract clause, under the U.S. Constitution contract clause, if it was reasonable to serve a legitimate public purpose. In fact, even in DeWitt, if you look at the DeWitt decision, when before they articulate the three-part test, they explain how they get there, and they cite a 1920 case by this court in which that where the court said that the contract clause has to be read to permit legislative action that promotes the common weal with general good of the public. In other words, at the time of McPhail and Bills, the court was well aware of their, under the interpretation of the contract clause, that gave the government entity the right under certain circumstances to impair their contract. But this court made a policy decision, which we believe is the right one, that they could not impair that contract right. Now, it was against all of this that the U.S. Trust comes down in 1977, which articulates more clearly the Blaisdell test. And then, 11 years later, this court decides Peterson. And in Peterson, they don't cite to U.S. Trust or to Stamets, which is the decided the following year of U.S. Trust. They continue to follow the McPhail Bills dichotomy. So even if you conclude that U.S. Trust and its progeny, in 1977, the Supreme Court somehow changed the analysis, 10 years after that decision, this court was still taking the position and ruling that if it was a fully vested right, it could not be impaired. If it was a limited vested right, they applied the test, which in essence is a reasonable and necessary test. This dichotomy, quite frankly, that Bills and McPhail laid out makes a lot of sense. In McPhail, like here, like the plaintiffs here, the fully vested right is you have a retiree who has performed fully satisfied their end of the bargain. Their end of the bargain is a certain number of years of service and employee contributions into the plan, their share of their contributions into the plan. They are fully satisfied. They are now retired or vested and eligible to retire. And now all that's left to complete that contract is for the contracting party, the other contracting party, the state, to fulfill their end of the bargain. And that is to pay the promised benefit with the COLA. In Bills, however, since it is not yet, they haven't fully satisfied their end of the contract, they, at that point, they can say, the state, if it shows reasonable and necessary, then the individuals at least have a determination they can make. Well, I don't like the way this contract, the terms of this contract have changed. I'm not going to continue my share of the bargain any farther because I don't think the changes are fair to me or ones I want to live under. And they can get out of the fulfilling the complete end of the bargain, or if they do fulfill it, they understand they have fulfilled it under different terms. Now, even after DeWitt, the Attorney General's office has agreed with the McPhail, Bills, and Peterson determinate decisions. The first question in that case, in that opinion, was what, if any, limitation on the legislature to reduce the capacity of current employees even after they retire. The Attorney General completely followed the McPhail and Dills test. And I would point out that a year later, then Treasurer Kaufman appointed a committee, a commission led by Governor Lamb and by U.S. Senator Hank Brown to look at ways to fortify PARA. And following the AG's report, he made it clear that they would not impair in any way a current retiree's benefits under this commission, any of their recommendations. And they did it. It wasn't until the 2010 legislature did. We believe that the Attorney General got it right. And in fact, so does PARA. At least they did in 2008. Because in 2008, they sent out a retiree update to all these people who are retired, in which they said, they described for them the Attorney General's opinion, and said that we can't impair, we can't change the fully vested pension of our retirees. So 3 years, or 4 years, after the Attorney General's report, PARA was still taking the position and agreeing that the analysis that we are asking this court to apply was the correct analysis. The Attorney General took it, PARA took it, both defendants in this case.
The Attorney General's very much so take the position that you're incorrect about your analysis of the AG opinion. They contend that it's not only off point, but that it doesn't state what you say it says. What do you say to that, please, sir?
Well, the question I actually put it up with me. No, I didn't. Well, the question in the AG's report is, what if any limitations exist upon the legislature's ability to reduce the capacity of current employees to earn additional retirement benefits to assure the long-term actuarial soundness of the plan? That was the question, the first question posed to the Attorney General. And the Attorney General said there, once a PARA member fulfills all the statutory requirements for pension benefit, retires and begins receiving a pension, the member's fully vested pension right cannot be reduced by the General Assembly. Now, he didn't address COLA specifically, and we'll get to that in a moment, but he addressed the fully the pension right. Now, if the argument that the Attorney General is now making is that the COLA is different than the base pension,
I think that's the argument. So perhaps we should move to that.
Okay, we would strongly disagree with that. COLA is not a freestanding benefit. You don't get COLA on its own. All COLA is tied to the benefit itself. It's part of the benefit. I mean, if you stop getting the pension, you don't continue to get a COLA. You only get the COLA because you're getting the pension. It's all intertwined. It's all the same. It's part of your pension benefit, is the COLA. So when if you find, as the Attorney General found, and apparently they agree with, defendants agree with, if you find that the pension itself can't be impaired in any way, which of course is also our position, then part of that is the COLA, because it's all tied together. It's not a free thing. It's not like there's plenty of cases out there. We have freestanding benefits, health and welfare, health insurance, retiree health insurance type cases. Well, that's a freestanding benefit. So that can rise and fall on its own. the COLA doesn't rise or fall on its own. It deals with, it is part and parcel of the pension benefit that the individual gets.
Why isn't COLA like health insurance in that it does change from year to year in terms of how much you're entitled to or how much you have to pay? What really is the principal distinction there?
For some of these individuals, for those who retired after 2000, it doesn't change year to year. It's 3.5 every year. But even for those that it does, the post 94, pre 2000 people, where it potentially could change because of the CPI. It's different than health insurance because we're not arguing that for those where it can change, that the benefit itself, that the COLA is a set amount. We're saying that the promise of how you formulate it, just like the promise of how you formulate the base pension, has to stay the same. So in the case of post 2000, the formula is it's 3.5 across the board. In the case of pre 2000, there's a formula. You look at it, but it's a set formula. It's a mandatory formula. It's the CPI or not. It's not. It's not. And the reason it's different than health insurance, as I said, is COLA is not a benefit unto itself. It's just a way to allow the pension to have a current value. So it's worth something. If you retire 20 years from now, when inflation has changed the value of the dollar over 20 years, that you have, the benefit you were promised is worth, has the same value that it had 20 years earlier when you retired. When you retire, you plan a budget in large part for these pensioners. You plan it based on the pension benefit you're going to get with the COLA. And you sort of map it out. Well, the cost of food, the cost of housing, the cost of cars, the cost of gas keep going up. If all you're going to get is the base pension, then it changes your whole budgetary.
To me, you're arguing for a divestment of legislative authority here. There are plenty of people right now who didn't get raises the past 10 years because of the economy that are contracted with by the state of Colorado. Right?
There are plenty
of people. When they took those jobs and continued those jobs, they would have expected, hopefully, I use hopefully, the cost of living adjustment. There's no guarantee to that. Even for present employees, so why should that be with respect to the prospective argument that you're making, that the legislature somehow divested of the authority to make these decisions, particularly when they have to do with the fiscal integrity of the whole system?
Because the answer to that is, because for this particular right, just like the base pension, there is a contract that provides that they will continue it, that they are promised this. Unlike the current employee, I mean, McPhail and Bills dealt with this situation between the current non-fully vested employee and the fully vested employee, and they said for that current employee who isn't fully vested, if the state can show a reasonable and necessary thing, actual necessity, in the case of pensions, or the adverse is complemented by a beneficial change of equal value, or it's done to strengthen the pension plan, for those current employees, they can do that. But we're not talking about current people. We're talking about people who fulfilled their end of the bargain, have left. They're gone. They're retired. They have now completed their career. They did everything they were asked to do under the contract with this state. They did perform all their services. They made their contributions to PARA instead of taking that money as salary and investing it somewhere else. They did everything they were asked to do. They have now gone with an expectation that they will get this pension. And that's the difference than the current employee who doesn't get a pay raise. There's nothing in the legislature that guarantees anyone a pay raise every year during the term of their employment. not even these retirees when they were employed. There's nothing there. But there is something there that guarantees them a base pension under a certain formula and a fully vested, and a COLA, as long as they're...
Could I ask you a question in response to these questions, but also you said earlier, a number of times you've talked about promises, but, and then sometimes you've talked about fulfilling a bargain. But where I'm kind of curious is, do you think for purposes of contract clause, there is a difference between something that in normal contract terms we would distinguish as promissory estoppel, or relying to your detriment on a promise, from actually being a contract in which there's an exchange of promises? And the reason I ask that is because you peg the argument takes the COLA to the point at which retirement occurs, is that more implicitly an argument that the COLA should not be allowed to be changed after that point because the employee has relied to his detriment in choosing to retire at that level, rather than promising to give something up in exchange for the promise?
Well, the we hadn't made the promissory estoppel argument as a detrimental reliance argument, but I will say that in McPhail's and in Bill's, they talked about that in the fully vested, that you have fulfilled all the conditions of the promise. They then found it contractual because of the mandatory language. But they did find, they found the contract. The contract is, you shall receive this escalator clause. I mean, they describe what it is in McPhail and Bill's. You shall receive this, you shall be entitled to this exact language. And they found that was the contract. And then they found, so now we have a contract, and you look at and the difference between McPhail and Bill's, how do you distinguish? Why can they change it under the Bill's analysis if they can't change it under McPhail? Now is the fulfilling.
And does timing make any difference in terms of the nature of your argument? That is, you're not suggesting that when the employee agreed to come to work and give his services to the state, there was a contract and he's entitled to that same salary in COLA that was in effect when he made the decision to come work for the state?
Not at all.
No, you're arguing that he's entitled to the amount that he was promised at the time he left. And he based his, I thought your answer to Justice Hobbs, he based his decision on a prediction given that COLA.
Right, given that formula and that COLA.
Right, but is that the same thing as a contract? Does that, I mean, we say in terms of contract terms, and you both have cited cases, that the legislature has to have indicated its intent to establish a contract. With regard to the COLA at the time he retires, is that the same thing as the conditions that he agreed to when he came to work and exchanged his services for the state?
Well, I think when what the contract says is, what the contract is, when you retire, because you don't get pension benefits till you retire, when you retire, this is what you will receive, this, you shall receive this.
And that's exactly sort of the point. You're getting right to what I'm curious about.
Right.
And so is, can the worker be said, can the employee be said to have given something in exchange to the state in order to receive that retirement benefit?
Well, the way McPhail and Bills looked at it, and you know, every contract has consideration, and the consideration that the employee gave was X number of years, whatever the formula is, 25 or 30 years of service, and X amount of contributions toward the plan. That's their consideration on their end of the bargain. I'm not sure I answered your question, but I mean, that's the way McPhail and Bill's court looks at it.
You haven't talked much about the DeWitt case, and your opponents take the position that DeWitt really is the case that controls. What's your position with respect to that?
Well, first of all, let's be clear. DeWitt involved an insurance contract. It wasn't a, where the state was a contracting party. And our position on DeWitt is that all DeWitt did was articulate what the contract, how contract clause was to be interpreted in that case in a private contract, not with the state's contracting party, applying U.S. Trust, Stannis, those cases, which were decided in the 70s. But the concept of which DeWitt exists, which DeWitt flows from, is the concept that in the general case, the contract clause is not an absolute right. You can impair, in certain circumstances, a contract. That was not decided in 1977 when U.S. Trust was done. It wasn't decided in 2002 when DeWitt was decided. That was decided in the 20s and the 30s by the U.S. Supreme Court. And as I said, in DeWitt, they cite a 1920 case where they said you couldn't tear the contract to the reasonable good for the public purpose. So DeWitt didn't enunciate a new test on the overarching issue. It simply articulated for the first time in this court what the three parts of determining that applying U.S. Trust. I would point out that U.S. Trust was decided in 1977. 11 years later, this court affirmed McPhail and Biddles in the Peterson case. DeWitt is not a new law. DeWitt is just applying what's been the long-term law of this state and of the United States Supreme Court. I'd like to reserve the final 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Chief Justice Rice, may it please the court, Sean Conley representing Parrot. I'd actually like to begin with the second question presented, whether plaintiffs have their claim contractual right, because in our view, that's just bound with the entire litigation. We submit that Judge Hyatt correctly held that there is no contractual right to a fixed COLA formula frozen for life on the date an individual happens to retire. In evaluating whether the contract right exists, courts begin with the presumption that legislatures, in Justice Hobbs' words, do not divest themselves of the power to respond to changed circumstances in the future. Legislatures, after all, make laws, not contracts. For a legislature to make a contract, the law is well settled that two conditions must be met, and must be met unmistakably. There must be both language creating a contract, and there must be surrounding circumstances that confirm that the contract was created. In McPhail and Bills, the case is principally relied on by Mr. Rosenblatt, both those conditions were met. The Denver City Council in 1917 created a charter that had been unchanged for almost 40 years that said a retiree shall be entitled to one half of their salary and shall be entitled to any increase in that salary that happens to a later person occupying their position. The language was clear. Clear language of entitlement. Likewise, surrounding circumstances were clear. For almost 40 years, the Denver City Council had left that intact. Until in 1956, the City Council said, unexpectedly and unforeseeably, that we want to increase the salaries of existing police department employees, but not increase the retirement benefits that have been vested in the retirees. The court, in both those cases, McPhail in 1959 and Bills in 1961, properly held that that was a breach of the contract and that violated the contracts clause. We would submit that Bills and McPhail were essentially the contracts clause version 2.0. Version 1.0, rejected by Bills and McPhail, were the old Bedford and Berman cases. It said pensions are mere gratuity. There's no contractual protection to that, a mere gratuity. That was the rule of law properly in our view, jettisoned in 1959 by this court in McPhail. And again, based on the languages around the circumstances, the court properly held that the pension and the right to escalation there was a vested right that could not be impaired absent sufficient justification. Now, the reason I say it's version 2.0 is because that was the only issue that really needed to be decided in building the bill. At that point, the only issue is it, as Denver argues, a mere gratuity that has no constitutional protection? Or is it a contract right that deserves some protection?
We submit that the court properly held that it's a contract right and did not need to go further than that. Now, bring us to the current point in terms of, let's look at the Monitor test in U.S. Trust in 1977, in DeWitt, in after U.S. Trust. The Monitor test said, let's look at the language and surrounding circumstances. And let's do that in terms of PERA. Because the vested benefit under PERA is the right to the initial monthly benefit, and not, we submit, the right to the annual increases under a specific formula. And we look at that by the language of PERA statute.
Mr. Collins, is it your position that DeWitt is now version 3.0, to use your words? I mean, is that what we now need to be looking at?
Yes, and 3.0 would be, you know, a more refined analysis of when does a contract right exist and when may it be impaired. And we submit that that's what DeWitt kind of is version 3.0, which is bringing this court's contract clause analysis into the modern era.
Sure. Is it consistent or inconsistent with Bills and McPhail?
I'm sorry, Aaron?
Is DeWitt consistent or inconsistent with Bills and McPhail?
I think it's consistent with the result. It's consistent with the result of everything else. In our view, under Bills and McPhail, the result would be exactly the same, that there was a protected benefit and there was no overriding justification that could have justified that impairment. Where it might be in some tension with it is, when can that right be impaired? Because no such justification was offered by the city there. The city there didn't say that there's a contract right to leave a justification for impairment. They simply said there's no contract right, so near gratuity, we can dispense with it at whim.
Do you think that tension exists or has to be resolved in this case?
I don't think it has to be resolved. As I began, I think the dispositive issue here can be, is there a contract right to a COLA fixed formula? Question two, I think, can begin and end the analysis. And for that reason, I'd like to argue further why there is no contract right. Again, going back to language and circumstances. And I think we can distinguish the COLA from the base benefit, both in the language. If you look at the language of the PERA statute, in 801.1, section 801.1 of the PERA statute says that the monthly benefit is payable for the lifetime of the beneficiary, of the PERA member. COLAs are, say, in part 10 of the statute, specifically sections 1001, 1002, 1003, and those are the parts that were amended in SB 101 in 2010. And there is no language of duration. As Judge Hyde said, there's absolutely no durational language when it comes to a COLA increase. And then if you look at surrounding circumstances, COLAs have been in existence for about 40 of the years the PERA fund has been in existence. PERA was created in the early 1930s, and COLAs did not exist until around 1969 or 70. So they've existed for about 40 years, and again, as Judge Hyde pointed out, they've changed repeatedly at that time. They've changed at least 10 times over those 40-year periods. If you look at one of the plaintiffs in this case, it's former Judge Hallis. He came on the bench in 1972. When he came on, there was no COLA paid to judicial officers. The COLAs for judiciary didn't come into effect until 1974. So when he joined the bench, and in my colleague's words, formed his contract with the state, he had no expectation for any COLA. And then until 1988, COLAs for the judiciary, that were first created in 1974, was still at a lesser rate than the rest of state employees. So for much of his tenure, he had either no COLA or reduced COLA.
But is the argument that the contract was made when he left the bench, not when he joined the bench?
Well, again, if you look at the language of the statute, there's no basis for that. If you look at the circumstances, we would also say there's no basis for that, because when he left the bench, COLAs have been changed repeatedly, and when he left the bench, his COLA at that point was less than 3.5% or actual inflation. The very next year, the COLAs were changed to his benefit when it was raised in 2000 to the rate of 3.5% compounded without regard to inflation. And there were changes made throughout his tenure as a judge, throughout his retirement. And now he's saying, for the first time, taking back to this alleged contract I had in 1999 when I retired, that it was a contract that was in existence for less than 1 year because, without objection, it was changed next year at his retirement. So we would submit that both language and surrounding circumstances defeat any claim to a COLA protection based frozen on the specific rate on the date of retirement. As the first question presented, which I kind of take now to order, I guess, about the WIP, we would submit that the WIP applied modern contract clause analysis and that there's no basis for engrafting a special rule for pension cases. The WIP, as Mr. Rosenblatt points out, was a private contract, but it decided U.S. Trust, which was a public contract, and the Supreme Court and this court historically have not distinguished between private and public contracts. The argument that there should be some pension-based exception, we submit, fails for at least three reasons. First, as a matter of text, the contract clause is a unitary clause. It provides adequately, prevents and governs impairments of any contracts, public or private, pension or otherwise. So we submit as a plain matter, plain statutory and constitutional text, there's no basis for exempting pensions from that. Other states, in contrast, do have special protections for pensions. New York, Michigan, which is now suffering through the problems in the Detroit bankruptcy, Arizona, other states have both a contract clause and a pension clause. And those case courts properly held that pension clauses are analyzed differently because we have a textual difference to it. Second, as a matter of law, what plaintiffs are asking you to do is to say we're going to follow a different state contract clause analysis than would govern under the federal contract clause. They concede that under the federal contract clause, pensions are analyzed like any other contract. This court has been very careful in terms of saying if we're going to depart from the Supreme Court approach, U.S. Supreme Court approach, and federal law, based on an identically worded constitutional provision, there's got to be some either textual justification or historical policy justification. We submit that that does not exist here. And third, as a matter of policy, this is economic legislation, and there's no basis we can submit for straitjacketing a legislature from changing to changed circumstances. And nobody can foresee in 1994 what the situation would have been in 2014, or in 2014 what the situation is going to be in 2034. These are specifically, we would suggest, the types of decisions that must be left to the legislature if they can make the showing of reasonableness and necessity as to the need for impaired any contract. So we would submit as a matter of constitutional text, as a matter of this court's law, and as a matter of policy, that the WIT analysis should govern all contracts, public, private, pension, or otherwise.
Mr. Connolly, good morning. So your position is that it's the rate increase that is not a contract, not whether COLA is a contract.
You know, that's a difficult question, Justice Blair, but that is my position. That's my position that that's the only question presented here. That's the only question that Judge Hyde answered. Now, there's a spectrum. On one side of the spectrum is the base benefit, and we submit that that is clearly contractually protected. On the other side of the spectrum is our case, the specific COLA in effect on the date of retirement. We submit for language and circumstance reasons that's clearly not protected. I think if I understand your question, kind of that's the middle ground, is there some right to some COLA protection? And that analysis would have to turn on, which I think is not presented here, because the COLA was left in, there is a COLA protection still under in existence under SB 10-1. Most recently, they've gotten 2% annual COLAs, which are about the same rate of inflation, although it's no longer tied to inflation. But the question of if the legislature were to say we're going to abolish COLAs outright, we think the analysis would turn on, is there any language in the statute that prohibit that? We submit no. But circumstances, the second part of the factor, for at least 40 years, there has been some COLA protection. Ever-changing and variable, but there has been some COLA protection for 40 years. And we would submit that if that issue were ever presented to the court, you'd have to say, well, language cuts against that claim, but circumstances do support it. So I think we would have you think.
But not before us right now.
It's not before you. It's not what Judge Hyde held and what we're asking you to affirm. He held that there's no right to a specific COLA formula that happened to be in effect on the date of retirement, frozen for the lifetime of retirement.
Let me ask one follow-up question. Then, in the changed circumstances, you talk about that there's been a change over 10 times. And the formulas get a little more complicated. Have they always gone up, or have they gone up and then gone down?
There have been at least two negative changes. One in 1994, when the legislature abolished the cost of living stabilization fund. And that was a very important protection for many of those years, where it allowed COLAs to rise at the actual rate of inflation uncapped. So that was abolished in 1994, and there was also a provision called banking that in 1994 the legislature abolished any bank amendments. And I can tell you, and I explained that when I get to it. In 2000, again, banking still existed. The stabilization fund was gone, but in 2000, when they went to the fixed 3.5% formula, they limited any prior bank amount, and there's no longer any banking. So there are at least two detrimental changes that happened. And whether it's detrimental or beneficial is kind of hard to tell when you freeze it, when you have, if you gave it 3.5% fixed, as existed during most of the first decade of the millennium in 2000, is that better or worse than something tied to inflation? I guess it depends on what inflation was, and inflation happened to be low during that first decade. To the extent that these retirees bring you benefit when they got 3.5% bumps in 2008 and 2009, when it was actually deflation. So that's part of the reason why the tariff fund was in the predicament it was in 2010, and SB 10-1 responded to that.
Okay, can I characterize what you said then, just to be sure I had it right? The contract here includes an adjustable COLA that the legislature sets. It can go down or up, but when that is done for that particular increment of the monthly paycheck, then it becomes part of the contract.
Well, it becomes part of the benefit. I guess when the COLA applied to the benefit. So, I mean, if, you know, we would concede that their current benefits, if they were cut, if there was an actual cut to their current benefits, which include many years of COLAs, then that would trigger contract clause analysis. They would pass the first step. There would be a contract.
But the first point was here characterizing what the contract rate is.
I think that's the first question that you win, and everybody agrees that it has to be answered here under any analysis.
Right. Okay.
And then the question becomes, if there is a contract, right, and that's what Chief Justice Rice asked, we think that this could be begun and ended with the analysis if there's no contract right here, and that's the end of the case, so it could be pretty simple. But we also think if the court were to reach a question, it should say that the word applies to all kinds of contracts. And then finally, if it had to reach a question, if there was some kind of contract right, you know, was this reasonable and necessary? I guess our position on this, and Mr. Domenico is going to touch this a little more, but our position on that is, that's an issue that requires deference to the legislature, and I think, in a micro level, nobody was a winner at SB 10-1. Nobody was happy. I mean, certainly current workers are contributing more, working longer, and retiring earlier with less than any of these current plaintiffs. So they certainly weren't winners, and I'm not saying that these plaintiffs on a micro level and on a short-term level winners. Nobody was a winner, but on a macro level,
well, what I'm concerned here is the core security of the contract.
Yes, and well, we submit that there is no contract, and the question is, and the third question presented is, if there were a contract, is it reasonable and necessary? And our position on that fundamentally is that that's a policy judgment left to the legislature. This is economic legislation requiring very, very many complicated actuarial analysis, and I think the courts made clear, even when there's a state contract being impaired, this is still economic legislation. It's not a type of law that invades, requires strict scrutiny or fundamental rights such as arguably racial or marriage equality, intermediate scrutiny, nothing like that. This is simply a economic legislation that the courts have made clear require meaningful deference to the state. And in this case, the state was acting to respond to a crisis and was acting in a way that didn't take money out of the fund, but actually reinvigorated terror by requiring increased employer contributions, increased employer contributions, and at the end of the day, terror fund is more healthy now because more money is being put into it. And that's precisely the economic judgment that we submit that courts should defer to. So we ask the court to actually resolve this case at the first threshold level, but there is no contract right to a COLA fixed at a formula at any given date. And it chooses to do so to uphold the applicability of the liquidity analysis, and it doesn't need to reach the third issue.
Okay, under that view of the case, what's left to do in the trial court?
Nothing. And what's left to do is to affirm the trial court and say, Judge Hyatt, you got it right, and your judgment is affirmed. So reverse the court of appeals and put an end to this case and affirm Judge Hyatt resoundingly. That's what we ask the court to do. Unless there are any further questions, I'll transfer my time to Mr. Domenico.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Thomas.
May it please the court, and Dan Domenico on behalf of Governor Hickenlooper and the state of Colorado. Chief Justice Rice, I think you asked the key question in this case and identified the key fatal flaw in the plaintiff's case. The plaintiff's case depends entirely on the proposition that COLA payments are identical to and have to be treated the same as base core pension benefits. And that's wrong for at least three reasons. It's wrong as a matter of statutory construction, it's wrong as a matter of historical fact and practice, and it's wrong as a matter of the purposes and functions of a COLA, a cost of living adjustment, as compared to a a base pension benefit. Now, the Court of Appeals got a lot right in this case. It laid out the proper structure, asked the right questions, and analyzed the way the cases interact with each other right. Its error was in application, and in application of the very important principle, the important presumption that statutes simply should not be read absent clear evidence to the contrary, should not be read as imposing a contractual right that binds future legislatures. Now, the plaintiffs and the Court of Appeals, I think, were thrown off by the fact that there's mandatory language. The plaintiffs focus on the idea that the COLA statutes include mandatory language, which is certainly true. But all that means is they're meant to be binding, while in effect, on the executive, on PARA in this case. That's a very common form of statute. PARA was not free, isn't free while these statutes are in place to pay something other than what the statute requires. That's not the right question, though. The right question is whether the legislature in these COLA statutes clearly showed an intent to bind not just the executive, not just PARA, but also to bind future legislatures. And there's simply nothing in those statutes to support that. As Mr. Connolly explained, and as the district court carefully analyzed, the statutes that do create such contractual language, and I think, Justice Hobbs, you were getting at this, what is the contractual obligation? If you compare the language of the base benefit, what you put in times the factor, what you get out, your base benefit in parts 6, 7, 8 of the PARA statute, that includes language of entitlement, durational language. This is what you get for life. The COLA statutes in Part 10 simply don't, that language is conspicuously absent from the COLA statutes. So as a matter of statutory interpretation, it's simply a different treatment by the legislature of a cost of living benefit versus the base benefit. As a matter of historical fact and practice, as the district court painstakingly laid out, COLA benefits, unlike the base benefit, are consistently, constantly changing. Not just the dollar amount, but the actual formula is changed, has been changed dozens of times. As Justice Boatwright pointed out, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse, sometimes in a way that's not predictable whether it's going to turn out better or worse. But the key difference there is to recognize that unlike the base benefit, when changes are made to how you get your base benefit, your years, the factor, how you calculate highest average salary. When those changes are made, the changes have never been made to retirees. COLA changes always have applied, with I think a couple of slight exceptions in the 2000s, trying to avoid some of what we have here, always have applied both to current retirees and to current employees, future employees. So it's simply not true as a matter of fact or historical practice. As the court of the district court recognized, no one in 40 years has gotten what the plaintiffs claim now is their contractual right, which is a fixed formula in place the day you retire. No one has gotten that. That's simply not a reasonable thing to expect, that this will not be changed. It always has been changed. And finally, this makes sense. The statutory structure and this practice makes sense if you consider the purposes and function of a cost of living adjustment compared to the purposes and function of your base benefit. The base benefit is an individualized assessment. What you put into the system, how long you worked, what your salary was, what your employer contributed. It's about you, what you put in, you should get it back. The cost of living formula is not about you. It's about external economic factors, including the inflation and the health of PARA. It's always been adjusted to relate to those external factors. That's why it changes, and that's why it changes for everyone. It would be a very strange system if we were to have a system that said, well, this group of people's cost of living should be adjusted differently than this other. Imagine back to 2000, when everybody was entitled to an increase, what turned out to be a pretty generous increase in the cost of living to a flat 3.5 compounded factor. If the legislature at that time had said, well, we're not going to give this to people who are retired, this is only for future retirees, not people who are already eligible, because they don't have a right to it, we're going to treat them differently. These plaintiffs would rightly say, that's not what a COLA is meant to do. Why should we get a different COLA from everyone else? And so those three factors, the statutory structure, the historical fact and practice, and the reasons you have these different aspects of your what you get from PARA, all point against treating them identically. They've never been treated that way statutorily or in practice. Now, we agree, of course, with PARA's arguments that this case should end with the question of whether there is a contractual right, the question the court presented, whether there's a contractual right to a fixed COLA formula in place as of the date of your retirement. The answer to that has to be no. If the court wishes to go on, though, to the other factors under the WIT, which it certainly could, it could, I suppose, assume that there's a contract. I think it's better to just affirm the district court's ruling. But if it were to move on and ask the other questions that the WIT says should be asked, the next question then is, has the state's action impaired this contract? This question then would really highlight why what we're talking about here is not an elimination of a COLA completely. The state has not done that. The impairment question looks to factors such as reasonable expectations, foreseeability, as the district court's analysis of the constantly changing COLA formulas, not just COLAs, but COLA formulas, shows it's not reasonable to expect that this won't be changed even during your retirement. It always has been changed, even for retirees. So this is just like the change in DeWitt foreseeable. It is a highly regulated area. It's in fact entirely dependent on statute. And the essential elements, or as the district court put it, the fundamental mechanism for receiving your benefits aren't changed. You still get your base, you still get what you put in, the factors haven't changed. We haven't said, well, we're gonna go back and say, it's your highest average 10-year salary or something like that. The fundamental mechanism remains the same. You still get a COLA, you still get protection.
Can I interrupt you there and ask one question? So is that my way of saying that no matter, I mean, even if there was a contract, because for us to move on to DeWitt, you're taking a position or saying, assuming we would find a contract, you're still saying it would always be unreasonable that a retiree could never rely to his detriment, in effect, if we want to use that language, on an expectation that he would continue to receive the COLA that was in effect and upon which he based his decision to retire.
I think that's right. If you look at DeWitt itself, the contract, is there a contract question, was very simple there. There was a clear, inarguable contract. So the court then moved on, well, does this count as an impairment? Which is a different question than sort of a commercial litigation, did someone breach the contract? It's a higher standard for what constitutes an impairment, specifically a substantial impairment. And so yes, one of the main factor there is reasonable expectations. Could someone reasonably expect that the state will never change the formula that's in place for retirees? We submit, as the district court recognized, no, that's not reasonable. These things always change. And unlike with your base benefit, if the state had gone in and rated people's bases, then I think you'd be in a very different situation. You would, in fact, have a substantial impairment, I think, very likely in that case. That never is done. It's never changed for retirees. Once you've retired, your base benefit has always been treated as fixed.
Would that be the case, do you think, even if the state, passed something that made it clear they were seeking to get people to retire, and they offered them a specific COLA as part of that agreement?
I think that's a very good question. I think if you had, say, a severance package, early retirement type package, where you're trying to get people to retire, and you said in that package, we will not reduce either your base benefit or your cost. You'll be also entitled contractually to this COLA, then yes, then the state or whoever entered into that would have bound themselves to that. They haven't done that here. That's just not what has happened. And it's, again, if you look at the statutes, if you look at the practice, the state has never treated it that way.
And so even under the DeWitt formula, you don't think the state could go back on such an expression?
If the state, again, say the state went into people's base benefits. And I think we've conceded, we recognize that people's base benefits are contractually protected. That gets you past step one on DeWitt. I would submit that that would likely be, I mean, there could be some argument that it wasn't a substantial impairment, but say it was a substantial impairment. The plaintiffs would still have to overcome the final factor, which is whether the change was reasonable and necessary in response to a legitimate public interest. And clearly, we think if ever there was a circumstance where that's the case, it would be in this instance, even if you got there here, which obviously we don't think under any of the three prior questions they've satisfied their burden. But even if you got there, the state would still be able to show under these circumstances. I think the plaintiffs can see that saving HERA, trying to get it back to be actuarially sound, is in fact a legitimate public purpose. As I said, the Peterson case, and actually Bill's too, show you the question you ask, what is the reasonable and necessary test, is used in those cases. And trying to shore up a pension fund that the plaintiffs themselves benefit from is in fact, sort of by definition, a reasonable and necessary change.
Mr. DiMicco, tell me just very quickly again why you think what the principal difference is between why the PERA benefits themselves are contractual and the COLA is not contractual.
Again, I think the key difference is the statutory construction difference. Part 10 doesn't include the durational language that says you're entitled to this for life. It simply says, while this statute's in effect, here's how we calculate the benefit. It's a little bit similar to our College Opportunity Fund, the COF statutes. This is the program we have now, you get these benefits, but unlike, they don't say in that statute, you're entitled to this for life. The base in Part 8, especially 801, says you're entitled to this benefit for life. The historical fact and practice is that these have always changed. Again, the COLA formula has always changed for retirees, just like it's changed for current employees. That's very different from how the practice has operated for the base benefit.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Rosenblatt?
Yes, since I didn't get to this question that they spent most of the time on, I think I wanted to address it. First of all, I want to disagree with my colleagues as to what creates the base contract, the base pension contract. It is 24-51-602, which reads that members, and then there's some language about exceptions as to who's covered, stated in the following table, shall upon written application and approval of the board receive service retirement benefits pursuant to a benefit formula set forth in other parts of the statute. So it's shall receive is the language that creates the contract of the base pension, which they agree is the contract. And the COLA says shall, it uses the same mandatory language. The language they talk about, the durational language that they speak of, is under a section that says, okay, these are your options. Option one is the retiree can take all the money for themselves for their life. Option two is they take a lesser amount for their life and then their surviving spouse life, and it goes like that. But the actual creation of the contract is based on the mandatory language shall receive in 24-51-62. And I would submit that that mandatory language is the same as the mandatory language in the COLA. And as the Court of Appeals correctly pointed out, because we both agree that the Court of Appeals got part of this right, we just disagree on which part they got right. The Court of Appeals said, in the language is the same as in where they found the contract in McPhail and Bills, and it's there was shall also. It's the mandatory language that created the contract. There is no distinguishing factor. As far as Justice Boatwright's question concerning have there been any changes to the detriment, since 1994, which is when the class that we have begins, there's been no change to the detriment of any current retiree. In 2005, contrary to what the Solicitor General said, they decided to change treating everyone identically with TCOLA. And they said in 2005, and it was based on a recommendation from the Commission, and in our belief, based on the McPhail Bill's analysis that Attorney General Salazar had followed, they said in 2005, for future retirees, not for current retirees, but for future retirees, it's going to be a different COLA formula. So already they had created a different COLA formula for post-2005 retired people who vested fully vested after 2005 than people who fully vested before. So the idea that it was identical is just not correct.
Mr. Rosenblatt, may I ask you, if right now you want to lock them in during a period of deflation, if we get to a period where we have inflation or hyperinflation and the legislature says, boy, to match the cost of living, we need to go to 6%, would your class be entitled to that increase, or would they be stuck at the 3.5?
They would not be entitled to it. That doesn't mean they might not get it, because the contracting, the other side of the contracting party, as they have done over the years, said, this is all you were entitled to, but we are going to give you more, though we're not trying to enforce that more. We are not, in this case, saying that you should get the additional amounts that were changed, like the 1994 people don't have as good a rate as the COLA as the 2000 people. We're not saying that they gave them the 2000 rate. We're not saying that they get the 2000 rate. We're saying they get what they're entitled contractually to what they got at the time that they fully vested. That doesn't mean they can't be given it, but we couldn't come to court to enforce, which is, I think, really your question.
Right.
We couldn't come to court to enforce that 6% for those who are already retired.
Thank you.
So I want to emphasize as to the first question that it is clearly is a contract in place, and we believe that this court should continue, as it did in Peterson, to follow McPhail and Bills and apply the fully vested COLA rate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to thank you, Mr. Rosenblatt, Mr. Conley, Mr. Domenico, for your arguments this morning.